Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. I'm rushing to finish my little book on Hillary Clinton, forthcoming late this year from OR Books, over the next couple of weeks, and I just didn't have time to prepare a fresh show this week. So today, two older interviews, one with the anarchist Ian Bone, and the second with the historian Bethany Morton. First, Ian Bone, from an interview first broadcast in March 2007. I'll hand it over to an 8 years younger version of myself to do the intro. Ian Bone is a British anarchist who's been involved in radical politics since the 1960s. He reached his pinnacle of fame in the 1980s when he was part of the impolite resistance to the savage reign of Margaret Thatcher. He's especially known for his association with Class War, which started as a newspaper and then became a political movement of sorts and even, on occasion, a punk band. I recorded this interview with him yesterday. You'd hardly know from listening to him that he'll turn 60 later this year. Talking with people like this always makes me feel uptight and cerebral, but such is my fate in life. While this may be the funniest of the hundreds of interviews I've done on this show, Ian Bone is also thoughtful and even inspiring. Bone is the author of a memoir, Bash the Rich, True Life Confessions of an Anarchist in the UK, published in Britain by Tangent Books and available in the US from AK Press. Ian Bone. Welcome, Ian Bone. Anarchism is a familiar presence on the radical American left. How big is it in Britain?
Probably no bigger than it is in the States at the moment. It's something, to be honest, there's very few sort of there's a whole range of armchair anarchists who never get out their armchairs to do anything. But in terms of out on the streets action kind of anarchists, which is the tradition which I identify with, not very many.
Did it have an experience of growth in the 80s when most of your book is about?
Yeah, it tends to go cyclical, really. There was a growth in the 60s around the time of the sort of hippie love-ins in 67 and sort of street fighting man against the Vietnam War in 68. Another sort of growth around 77, 78 with the advent of the punk movement. Again, in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher, the sort of the class struggle wing of anarchism came to the fore again. And again, with the anti-globalization movement in the 90s, another upsurge. So it seems to be something when you're a new generation of people coming through every 10 years who get interested, hang about for a bit, and then give up after 2 years of getting nowhere.
You write some about your parents and their labor socialist politics, labor as in the party. How did that influence the evolution of your own politics? Did was it a positive example, a negative example, a bit of both?
I think it was a bit of both. I mean, my dad was a butler, which meant he was sort of serving rich people in country mansions all his life. I mean, mum was a housemaid. They call it in service over here, and it isn't much different to being in servitude. So the class conscious anger was coming at me from a kid all the way through. And my dad was bizarrely a socialist butler, so he was wrestling with his politics at the same time as trying to serve members of the ruling class at dinner table. So it was quite a unique and also quite a funny in some ways upbringing, but it certainly shaped my sort of analysis of class politics in the future.
You said you became an anarchist reading Punch magazine at the age of 15. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I worked out on my own that I believed in something. I wasn't quite sure what it was. It was something which had no government, no laws, no rules, and you could do what you like, and life might be short, but it would be meaningful, and I didn't have a name for it. And I was reading an article in Punch magazine while waiting to the dentist, and there it was. There was a very sarcastic article about the British anarchist headquarters with men with beards and women with beards, come to that, and it actually put the address down at the bottom, and I gingerly wrote off and asked them to send me some literature with a covering letter saying, please don't send anyone with a large beard to my house because my dad will freak out.
Your parents came out, were associated with this kind of very organized, institutionalized politics, the Labour Party, trade unions and such. Anarchism is anything but. How do you feel? Is that, were you trying to move away from that kind of institutional ossification?
Yeah, there was. I mean, for us, it was clear that voting Labour wasn't getting anywhere, that Labour just sort of administered capitalism slightly different to the Tories. I mean, it's much the same now. Labour-Tory doesn't really make much difference. And I guess it was all product of that counterculture which came about in the 1960s. And we didn't want piecemeal reform. We wanted to overthrow the state. We wanted everything then, now, if not yesterday. So it was a much more immediate, no sense of deferred gratification. We knew what we want, and we thought we knew how to get it in the event we didn't quite achieve either.
A lot of people feel that way in their adolescence. How did it linger into your full-grown adulthood?
Yeah, no, I haven't grown up. I'm still behaving disgracefully. I mean, I'm still as passionate about anarchism. I still believe the same tactics and the same direct action confrontational approach is what will get us somewhere eventually. I've got a lot more sort of jaundiced view, I guess, of the 40 years of struggle, which are generally on the left printed, you know, painted as 40 years of triumphalism and this, that, and the other. A much more jaundiced sense of having organised more fiascos than triumphant events. But I think a sense of humour, and looking back at what we did, is probably pretty absent from most leftist politics. So the sense of humour can actually help you persevere a lot longer than being totally moralistic and straight up about it.
And then there's also, you write about how the Trots were the enemy. They had to get rid of them. Tell us about the Trots.
Yeah, we never quite managed. They're still an irritant around. The Trots, I mean, we have a particular Trot organisation in Britain called the Socialist Workers' Party, which takes over and fronts every possible genuine grievance that comes up. If it was a swimming pool need closing down, or a road that needed rebricking, or it was the war in Iraq, the Socialist Workers' Party be around your house saying they've always agreed with the struggle and can they lead it and you can be part of it. And they're totally parasitic, and they haven't gone away. At the moment, they're allied to the Muslim Association of Britain, which is a peculiar mix of secular socialist and Islamic fundamentalists. But at least that way, they can say they're increasing in numbers, which they have to do to keep their membership in its sort of permanent state of retarded ejaculation about the possibility of revolution.
They seem to think that the anti-war movement is their own subsidiary, don't they?
Yeah, they lately dominate everything. They always have been writing the guise of front organisations, which are easily spottable because the same figures come up again. And they have effectively disillusioned so many people in this country. One generation or another has sort of been lured into front organisations by the Socialist Workers' Party, got fed up when they seen what's happening. And there's a hierarchy there which has stayed there. I mean, the leaders of the sort of anti-war movement in Britain now are the same leaders who were leading the anti-Vietnam War movement in 1968, people like Tony Benn, Ken Loach, Vanessa Redgrave, Terry Carley, and they saddled themselves with the same leaders, with the same sterile, just marching against the war, which has no effect whatsoever, tactics. So we've lost lots of battles with them, but we aim to win in the long run.
What would you see as a more effective anti-war tactic?
Well, I think certainly in this country we should have been out on the streets, blocking the roads, causing some disruptions to the work and to government. I mean, it was a march 4 years ago when it all started with over 1 million people on it, which just marched along to hear various Trotskyist speakers, bishops and Muslim fundamentalists talking in Hyde Park and then go home. And then they repeat the exercise every year or two. And the one they just had now, it's the law of diminishing returns. There was something like 20,000 people on. And the message at the end of the day was, this is a great triumph, now go home and build for the next one next year, and you might catch yourself on telly at the end of the day. With 1 million people on the march, we could have caused significant disruption. And actually, you know, add some effective opposition to the war.
Yeah, let's go back to the 60s for a bit. There was a lot going on, and there was like very sort of conventional Marxist-Leninist politics or the hippies. How did you and the anarchists fit into all that?
I think 68 was the real. I mean, I was a peace and love hippie in 1967. By the end of 1968, I was a sort of fire-breathing, petrol-bomb-throwing, full-on anarchist. And I think it was the events in Europe, really, particularly Paris, May 68, all the events around the world, including in the States, the Democratic Convention. There was stuff going on around the world, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. I mean, it didn't make sense to be a pacifist anymore. I think tons of us were overnight converted from sort of that period around about May 1968 into being sort of direct action pro-violence anarchists. And it really did. I mean, it certainly looked as though it was happening. Certainly Paris 68 looked as though there was going to be a revolution. And it meant the revolution wasn't some old idea, you know, from Kropotkin and Bakunin, but it was possible. And I've retained that belief ever since.
Yeah, you're certainly no friend of the pacifists. You use a lot of violent rhetoric. Is that symbolic, or do you actually mean you want to mug the rich and blow things up?
Yeah, I think we've never been part of the blow-up tendency. We've always condemned, I mean, the blow-up tendency, whether it's the Angry Brigade in this country or various other groups around them, would have always tended to be people, middle-class radicals who got fed up trying to get, hoping that the working class might do something. So have supplanted them and decided to act on their own initiatives on their behalf. And they generally tend to be middle class and a very short shelf life. I mean, in terms of the kind of tradition we emphasise with is getting out on the street, the riot tendency with a brick in one hand and a petrol bomb in the other. In fact, John Barker, who was one of the jailed Angry Brigade, is in this country, said recently at a meeting I was at that petrol bombs are far more democratic than dynamite, and that's the tendency to which we still adhere.
I'm speaking with Ian Bone, the veteran British anarchist and author of the book Bash the Rich, just published by Tangent Books in the UK and available from AK Press in the United States.
Let's talk about Class War, which was a newspaper, a movement, a band. Tell us about the evolution of it.
Class War. It was. I mean, it started off as a newspaper with no aspirations to be anything else. But it came out in the early 80s when you have to put it in the context of Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, who was a very full-on class warrior, just on the other side to us, and the left was just lying down and being trampled all over. And so we, while some sections of the working class were fighting back, either in inner city riots or in the miners' strike and the printers' strike, and we said, yeah, it's fine to fight back. It's good to fight back. It's good to throw bricks back at them. Whereas the left used to show pictures of people beaten up by police, we used to have a series of photos called Hospitalised Copper, which shows coppers that we'd put in hospital. And it struck a chord in the 80s because people really were fighting back. Thatcher did mount an all-out war on the working class. And the other thing, Class War did it with humour, and that was a perplexing thing for many people. They couldn't work out, is Class War a comic, or is it a serious newspaper, because there's so lack of humour on the left. And by default, it turned into a political movement, because people liked the paper so much, and then people started saying, we formed a Class War group here, there, and everywhere. And all of a sudden, we had a fairly significant movement, which is fairly confrontational. It was never part of an organised plan. It was never organised in terms of branches. It was just spontaneous local branches. And I think from about sort of 84 right up to the poll tax riot, which really did for Thatcher, in the early 90s, we were more of the opposition than the Labour Party was.
You also have a history of the amateur musician. Tell us about your musical career.
Yeah, extremely amateurish. Taking advantage of the punk movement in 77, we formed a band by accident, and we realised it was just another way of getting ideas over, in the same way as Class War got some ideas over. First record happened to coincide with The Pope as it in Britain, so we knocked out a record called The Pope as a Dope. On the other side, funnily enough, it was about the same time that the assassination attempt on Reagan in the States, so we were stuck for something. All my lyrics always rhyme, so I think whoever had fired at Reagan had tried to use fired down dum-dum bullets, so we issued a track called Dum-Dum Bullets for a Dum-Dum Dummy about the failed Reagan assassination attempt. And we continued in a whole series of tasteless songs ever since. A little number knocked out for the royal wedding of Charles and Di called Better Dead Than Wed, which had been updated, and is much more of a sort of sing-along and a straight-on punk band. But, just another way of getting ideas over with a sense of humour and something that people can relate to.
I found a remake of Better Dead Than Wed on the web. What's the story of that?
Yeah, we just revamped. There's a narco-punk band over called Conflict. And there was yet another royal wedding of a couple of parasites, the Earl of Wessex, and I can't even remember his missus's name there. So we just did an update of the version for that, which Conflict put on their website. And because it's about 30 years since punk in 77, there's been a whole spate of punk stuff. And as we all know, punk doesn't die over here. There's tons of people walking around with studded leather jackets with Punk's Not Dead on the back. And a lot of them hadn't heard the original version of Better Dead Than Wed, so they're happy to snap the other one up.
Yeah, you used the word parasite. That reminds me, you write about how Ian Jack was fascinated by your use of language. You're not afraid of words like parasite, but also a lot of antique language. What is your thinking behind that?
We think it was important to reinvent sort of language of class struggle. So we use words like toffs and the snooty rich and snobs and stuff like that, which goes back to sort of, if anyone's seen a comic, that the Beano and the Dandy tend to have characters which talk about snobs and toffs and the posh. And we consciously use a sort of Victorian language to describe the rich. Because one of the things about Class War was that we didn't like the rich, but we didn't just hate the system. We hated them individually, and we wanted to personalise it. And Class War was just as much about spitting at someone rich you saw going down the road. It was about getting on an organised demonstration somewhere. So you wanted to personalise it, and when that kind of invective, which also, again, had a sort of sense of humour to it, we organised the Bash the Rich March. And first of all, which was to march into a rich area saying we don't like you very much. And people said, can you just do that, organise a Bash the Rich march? And we said, yeah, you can. And we did it. And it sort of brought home to a whole generation of people that class politics could be personal, and it was a way of venting your frustration on the system, much more so than just struggling against an amorphous the system, capitalism or something like that.
I think a lot of American audiences don't know what a toff is. So can you define it for them?
Yeah. A toff is basically the landed gentry in this country, the super rich, the landed aristocracy have always controlled Britain, who still own about 85% of the land, and who generally look down on anyone, not even on new money, but certainly on people who come from lower class origins, who they still tend to treat as servants or someone they should be out blasting their shotguns off if there's no grouse or pheasants to shoot.
And while we're talking about the British class system, what about the Chows? They've made a big splash. So far, it's even gotten over here. What do you think?
There's an attempt to sort of demonise. Middle-class ideas have sort of pervaded everything over here in terms of even the sort of protest movements are run by the middle classes. Everything from TV, it used to be just finance and government and corporations that the upper and middle classes used to run. Now the upper classes run everything from alternative comedy to films to music. They're all run. As soon as they open their mouths, you know, basically there's some middle class person talking. And what they've done in the meantime is to sort of demonise the rest of the working class, who's ignorant, pig ignorant, racist, low life scum, who are basically chavs who know nothing. And anyone who's working class may have basically is categorised as chav scum. And I guess we'll be working hard to sort of use some of those chav scum words, to use them in a way that we can use the words to fight back by calling ourselves chav scum and taking the fight back to them.
I'm speaking with Ian Bone, the veteran British anarchist and author of the book Bash the Rich, just published by Tangent Books in the UK and available from AK Press in the United States.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You say you wanted to personalize the struggle. A lot of people talk about it's the system and the people are just pawns of a little larger system, but you don't think that's the way to do politics?
No, we think it is to personalise it, and I think that was class war's great breakthrough, and that's why we got patronised by the rest of the left when we talked of jostling the rich in the streets. There's a thing that happens over here every year called the Henley Regatta, which is loads of posh people in boaters and frocks and old school ties, yachting and rowing at Henley, and it's a real gathering of the rich social calendar, and we mobilised about 500 people to go there one year. Because most people haven't seen what the rich people look like en masse. I mean, they are truly loathsome and horrible. And when you see them with their sort of chinless wonder types in their OKRs and all that, and I think we had a whole generation of people there who've never seen the rich, really, have never seen how ghastly they are together. And people came away from there absolutely fuming. They said they can't believe there's people like that in this day and age. I think appeals to get rid of the system and overflow the corporations are all very well, but I think to bring it home, you really need, and also to vent your own anger. You know, you can't just rant against faceless bureaucracies all the time, and it fitted in very well with my background anyway, because I do really hate them. So it was a political movement constructed on that.
You say you rejected the traditional anarchist cloak of anonymity. You wanted to get out there, use publicity, and use the press, and use the media.
Yeah, we talked to the press. We thought we had our own newspaper, Class War, which sold about 15,000 copies a month, which in English anarchist terms was a hell of a lot, because the other magazines about the time were selling 500 to 1,000. It did manage to break out of the ghetto and talk to ordinary working class people. But we thought, hey, there's other people producing papers. You know, the big circulation tabloid newspapers in Britain have circulations of 3, 4, 5 million. So when the press wanted to expose us in the papers as a gang of violent anarchists struggling to overthrow the state, I mean, most anarchists would run a mile and not speak to them or deny it. And we said, yeah, we are a gang of anarchists struggling to overthrow the state. Thanks very much. We're quite happy to do an interview. And, of course, the interviews were always how terrible we were, and we were this, that and the other. But we always found our post bags sort of full of hundreds of letters weeks later, because these newspapers had circulation of millions, and we found a way of using the stories they wrote about us to turn back on them and to use to our own benefit. And we were quite happy to raise the size of sellout or your minute, you know, working with the capitalist media, because we thought, well, that's just a recipe for failure. No, we want to get our ideas out, whether it's in capitalist newspapers, in songs like Better Dead Than Wed, or in tatty newspapers like We Can Produce, or any other means, you know, by any means necessary. Actually means by any means necessary. It don't necessarily just mean posing around with a machine gun.
How'd you earn the honor of being named the most dangerous man in Britain?
Yeah, that was fun. So my mum read it. Yeah, I was living off the glory of that for a couple of days. So I had a phone call off my mum, and some homely neighbour had said, you know, your son's the most dangerous brand. But he is bloody well not the most dangerous brand. I won't have you saying that. And then she showed him the story in the Sunday newspapers. And bizarrely enough, it started off as the most dangerous man in Britain, which is pretty cool, actually. But somehow, in the later edition, the one my mum saw was the most evil man in Britain, which doesn't have quite the same sort of Che Guevara kudos. It smacks a bit more like a serial psycho killer or something. So, yeah, my mum had diarrhoea for 2 weeks over that. And one of the things that strikes you is that, you know, other countries, people are getting shot for being a revolutionary. In this country, you just have to worry about your mom having diarrhoea for 2 weeks.
Well, in the U.S., you get ignored. You don't even get profiled here. What about your relation with you're involved with the miners' strike, the printers' strike, I guess it's when Wapping and Murdoch was busting the printers and all.
Yeah.
Now, these were strikes run by traditional bureaucratic institutionalized unions.
Yeah.
What was the anarchist relation to these entities?
Well, we took the, I mean, the unions, though, I mean, the National Union of Miners was more militant than certainly the leaders of the printers' unions were. But after a while, there was a whole rank and file came up. We were fighting a different battle to the union leaders. The union leaders wanted to use the sort of the workers as a stage army to, you know, to wheel on and win the fight, and also not to upset the apple cart for a future Labour government, which is always what they were thinking of. So don't do anything too naughty, just win the battle of public opinion. It was clear with Mrs. Thatcher that public opinion counted for nothing. The unions still thought they could win some sort of moralistic, get nice stories about Saltley Earth miners. Thatcher realised she only wanted to win, and that was to crush both the miners and the printers. And we worked that out fairly early on. So we said the only way to win this strike is by using violence, by blocking the roads, by using more violence than Mrs. Thatcher's prepared to use, by making it impossible to sustain the odds, because she's only got so many riot police she can pull about the country, and the mines are all over. And if we can, we'll instigate the second front in the inner cities of inner city rioting, which was quite possible in Britain in 81, 82, 85. So we attacked the union leaderships. I mean, the unions just became as much as a fetter on the workers as anyone else. And the miners, for example, developed a whole rank-and-file initiative, not just of looking after their own families and raising money and food parcels, but actually of organising hit squads to go around the picket lines to launch attacks on NCB property and so on. And we linked up with them early on. And, you know, we were all quite happy. They didn't care if we weren't miners. We didn't care if they weren't anarchists. We all worked together. And a lot of the miners we met then are still pretty heavily politicised now in one form or another. Eventually we lost, but for about 3 months it was a darn close run thing in the miners' strike as to who would rule Britain, and we did lose. But I guess in 1992, when the poll tax riot happened, a lot of those old defeated miners and printers were wheeled out on that riot and the other riots around the city. So you could say we might have lost those two wars, but I think we certainly won one of the battles against Thatcher in the end.
Towards the end of the book, you write about how, to be honest, a radical has to ask the question of why there are so few revolutionaries in the world,
yeah,
if we're supposedly fighting for the masses. Reflect on that for us.
Yeah, I think that's a question which radicals don't reflect on. And so many organisations, anarchists included in this country, are so sort of triumphalist about everything. You know, you get 30 people on a demonstration, it's rounded up to 3,000, and people are treated like idiots, so they can't see results of their own eyes and believe what they say. And I think that we have to say, you know, given that we obviously live in an inequitable system, and you know, I think in this country something like 4% of the people own sort of 96% of the wealth. So how come that patient propaganda explaining this to people doesn't actually come about? And I think that's because people have lots of other, you know, the rational approach of explaining to people the inequities of capitalism just don't work. People are persuaded by all sorts of other things in their life, the irrational. And they have all sorts of desires and urges which aren't compassed by political movements. So I think, you know, we look back to the old sort of Wilhelm Reich ideas. You need to politicize the betting shop, the bedroom, the hotel, this, that and the other, and you need to start from where people are, and you need to have a politics that actually relates to their daily lives. This is not what is seen as the sort of inverted commas political angle, and there are very few politicos who are happy doing that. Very few politicos who actually, you know, they go on about the working class, but they don't actually choose to live amongst them or go to the same shops or the same pubs or mix with working class people, because when push comes to shove, they're basically scared of working class people because they think they're all violent, racist, they smell and they don't have the correct politics. And until we can do something about that, we won't get very far.
And finally, what about life in Blair's Britain? The 70s, look back in the 70s, it was stultifying in a way, the welfare state and the union bureaucracies and all. But now Blair's Britain is stultifying in a different kind of way, as a kind of celebration of wealth and an alliance with the United States. How do you do radical anarchist politics in what seems like a very unpromising environment?
Well, I think it has been very unpromising. And, I mean, I think loads of people are walking around in this country saying, well, the working class is defeated. And there is very little sign at the moment of organized opposition. But I think the peculiar thing about the Britain at the moment, it's got a very much a feel of the mid-1980s when Thatcher was at her height and waging class war. Because what Blair's created is like a, you know, exactly what Thatcher created. You've got sort of all the big companies being sold off to private equity companies. You've got huge city bonuses in the city with people sort of with a loads of money attitude earning about £10 million in bonuses. You've got in London the sort of advent of the super rich now, not just the Russian sort of billionaires, but the real super rich and a kind of conspicuous consumptive wealth which is actually galling to working class people. At the same time, you've got it very difficult for working class people to get on the rung of the housing ladder, affordable housing. I mean, there's nothing in London now not any kind of house in an old council flat on a third story of a tower block for less than £250,000. So there's a feel that sort of Blair has recreated Thatcherism, and there's a lot of sort of, and public sector wages are being kept down. And the bizarre thing is we're also seeing the return of the toffs, because David Cameron's been trying to market himself as ordinary bloke, but it's all come out. I mean, he went to Eton. His family owns a 35,000 acre estate in Scotland. His wife, who's just portrayed as an ordinary mill town girl, well, they didn't actually explain she owned the mill town rather than work there. So, I mean, whereas you've got sort of two dynasties over there, the Clintons and the Bushes, who look like they're going to be president for 16 years, 19 prime ministers in Britain have been to Eton College. How coincidental is that? David Cameron to be the 20th, leaving not counting Blair, who went to his fetties, which is basically the Eton of Scotland. So we seem to go back to sort of right back to sort of the toffs and the super rich running the show. And that, again, presents us with great opportunities to do something about that. So I'm pretty optimistic about the way things have turned out at the moment.
And that was Ian Bone, the British anarchist and author of the political memoir Bash the Rich, published by Tangent Books in the UK and available from AK Press in the US. That interview with Ian Bone was first broadcast in March 2007. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Class War by The Exploited from 1981. And now an interview, somewhat truncated, with historian Bethany Morton, first broadcast in June 2009. Then a professor at the University of Georgia, and now at the Dartmouth History Department, Morton's excellent book, To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise, was published by Harvard University Press in that year. Many people have trouble parsing how evangelical Christianity and pro-market politics go together. Didn't Jesus drive the money changers out of the temple and say it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God? Morton's book is a marvelous study of how American culture can so easily reconcile God and mammon. Bethany Morton. Now, although Walmart is now operating around the world, lots of stores in Mexico and China, not so successful in Europe, but they've tried, but they're all over the place. But they did emerge from a particular corner of the United States and very rooted in a lot of ways in that Ozark culture. Talk a bit first about how the labor market that was created in the Ozarks was so suited to Walmart and its rapid growth.
Well, it's an unusual corner of the country in the sense that, we're all aware that the kind of Jeffersonian dream of the small subsistence farmer was really never a descriptor of most people's experiences, but it had a little more traction in a place like the Ozarks than it did in a lot of places. And so the result of that frequently was a sense of sort of family subsistence strategies, which kind of set you up for bringing whole families into waged labor when they do finally make that move. It created a very flat class structure compared to much of the rest of the South, which is, of course, characterized by plantation economies in many places. This was quite different. This was a little more, could more plausibly use that idea of, hey, if someone's wildly successful, we can look at where he started and we can say it's not because he came with enormous advantages over his neighbors. It's not because he took unfair advantage of them. It's because he sort of wisely used what's at hand. I'm not saying that that's a fair assessment of the situation, but it was not a completely implausible one in that setting. Bringing people out of farm economies directly into a service economy is a very different process, moreover, than bringing people out of farms and putting them in factories. So you produced the service economy had internal models, just as, you know, just as factories in Detroit had very particular work cultures that grew out of the particular milieu that they were employing. So did Walmart. So did discount stores, and right alongside them, evangelical churches, Christian colleges, all the other institutions that really contributed to this success story.
And you're from that part of the world yourself, right?
Absolutely. I'm from Mississippi, which is probably the one state that even Arkansas gets to laugh at regularly.
You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News.
And I'm speaking with Bethany Morton, who is the author of To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise, just out from Harvard University Press. Okay, let's do a little history of Sam Walton. He did like to present himself as kind of a self-made man, and the mythology was kind of self-made, but he did have some assistance from his wife's money, right?
Absolutely. A lot of the startup capital behind this came out of the Robson family, which in Oklahoma were large landowners, and that was loans from his father-in-law were often the startup capital. And meanwhile, the Walton family itself was hardly a sort of rags-to-riches story. These are people who were fairly substantial in, again, not a real high-wheeling part of the country. They had financial dealings. They had some government jobs. Of course, land was given away in that part of the world for free after being taken away from American Indians. So, we're not looking at a rags-to-riches story, as so often it is interpreted in hindsight. And to be fair, the Waltons did not run around, putting that forward themselves so much as they were interpreted that way by people who really liked to imagine that that was what was going on.
Well, yeah, people projected a lot onto Sam, didn't they?
Exactly.
And you also write quite a bit about how the South and the West, who are now notoriously very anti-government in their politics, have historically benefited enormously from government spending. How does that fit into the Walmart story?
Well, it's kind of a bargain that has been extended to a lot of white Americans, is the ability to imagine ourselves as self-made people, so that the naturalizing, to use a little bit academic language, of the
That's okay.
gifts that the federal government made to people in the 19th and 20th centuries were often, these gifts were often deliberately masked, so that, for example, I don't have to stand in line to get a mortgage deduction, but I would have to stand in line and submit my personal life to scrutiny to get what we call welfare. Now, they're both welfare, but the experience of each of them is quite different. And it's sort of that history that that the late 19th century, early 20th century populism to some extent enabled. And this part of the country is extraordinarily white. Northwest Arkansas, the Ozark area, was over 95% white for most of its existence in the 20th century. And so it does tend to mask some of the critiques that other Americans are able to bring of that model. Walmart, of course, it's very well documented, accepted massive subsidies for the creation of its distribution centers and many of its stores. There's no real sense in which you can describe any multinational corporation as a private entity. These are always public-private partnerships. And I think making that more explicit, as of course the bailout has made it explicit for everyone, ought to be part of our conversation about the national economy generally.
And to return to the Walmart history, Sam started with a couple of Ben Franklins and then became a globe-spanning giant, right?
Exactly. Again, not to imply that the man did not make extraordinary use of the gifts on his plate there. He took what was traditionally an economic sector that was sort of a haven for people without big ambitions. Again, a reminder that most people go into the market looking for subsistence, for some sense of satisfaction at work, some basic security, but not looking to create a multinational behemoth. And he took that model, which had very particular work traditions and economies behind it, and transformed the whole relationships within it. And, of course, this is all built into the post-war offshoring of production and the U.S. domestic economic boom that was based on, you know, our victory in World War II and the kind of absence of major competition for many years. So he's part and parcel of the kind of greatest generation story of itself, that as sort of a reward for the virtues of the Depression and World War II, this moment of great prosperity and decreasing wealth inequality and so forth was a product, in their telling of it, of virtue rewarded. And what we can see, of course, a little more analytically, is that it is a more complicated story than that. And Walmart, as the world's largest corporation since 2002, is a really good laboratory for looking at that relationship.
This is a part of the world. The Ozarks were not served by the chain stores that the urban north was served by. So what did Walmart do to fit itself into that underserved market?
Well, I mean, and this comes back to the kind of what's the matter with Kansas question, right? The Thomas Frank's very useful restatement of the big populist question from the turn of the century, that what's going on here? That you could get people who are demonstrably losing out under this economic model to continue to enable it politically. And the very phrasing of the question is, I think, problematic, because what you actually see with a company like Walmart is a much more, it's not duping people into voting for these kinds of economic policies by just hollering abortion, homosexuality. It's not the culture wars narrative that says that there's one set of reality we call economic reality, and then one set of phantom concerns that we call culture, and that the problem in this country, if you are a person who considers it to have been a problem, is that people keep responding to their cultural concerns and getting confused about their economic concerns. What Walmart had enough sense to learn from the people it was employing and the people who were shopping there and its home communities was, in fact, these are two intimately related, codependent spheres of life, that reproduction, reproductive labor, the labor of service, the labor of care that is now the majority of economic activity in this country, the majority of people's jobs are in service industries. That is a cheap pool of labor. Those jobs, it takes two service jobs to replace one manufacturing job. Why is that? Well, it's in part because we had a broad national agreement through the 20th century that manufacturing kinds of jobs involve skills, that the people who do them are worthy of stable jobs, of benefits, of the kind of government services that do not require standing in line at the welfare office. Whereas we agreed that the kinds of work that go on in people's homes, the work of care, the work of service, is not valuable. It's unskilled, and therefore it doesn't deserve to be honored with practical rewards.
And of course,
if everyone agrees with that, then it's really cheap to hire those people. And
this is very gendered too, right? The men are the skilled workers, and the women are the unskilled carers, right?
Precisely. I mean, that is the breakthrough that Walmart pioneered here, and that you see all over the world in this new economic post World War II moment, is that people figured out that if you can have women on the cheap, because we've all sort of agreed to pretend that the work they do is not really work, that it is not a necessary part, say, of industrial society to have someone at home looking after the children and feeding the industrial worker, then we're not going to assign any value to it, and they are themselves discounted. So what did Walmart do? Well, it didn't actually turn that equation around and say, we're going to pay these people a living wage, we're going to make these good jobs with serious benefits, not most of those jobs. But what it did do, and what evangelical culture did do, particularly after 1970, much better, I think, than anyone succeeded on the left in doing, was to say, we are going to honor this work. We are going to make it visible. We're going to call it the appropriate measure of value in the workplace. We're going to hold it up and say, if you want to be a good manager, you need to make yourself the student of a 50-year-old mom and learn to do her job as well as she does it. And, you know, you can be, it's easy to look at it and say, that's how silly of people to fall for that. What would really honor this kind of work would be to pay it well. Well, absolutely. But you have to look at what the options were on either side. Evangelical culture, red state culture, service workplaces like Walmart that stand in for red America, these kinds of places did better in many ways than the majority culture in placing service at the center of their hierarchy of values.
Yeah, and you write a lot about the servant, the culture that developed within evangelical Protestantism. What's that about, and how does it fit into the Walmart model?
Well, it's really striking how this language of service and servant leadership crops up across the literatures, both the kind of business advice literature, the management literature within the company, management training, Christian colleges that were themselves training managers for Walmart, Christian advice literature, missionary training manuals. These kinds of sources all show that there is, particularly after the 1970s, when suddenly virtually everyone in this country is going to wind up working in a service job at some point, that at that point they take a good look at service as a Christian virtue. Of course, it's always one of the available Christian virtues. There are many. And says, we're going to elevate this one. And they're very self-aware about it, saying that service work requires this reevaluation, that, for example, the international revolution against white supremacy, where suddenly missionaries are having to deal with non-white populations as equals, that that new reality requires service to be the major value. And so suddenly, even though you don't actually get a change in the authority figures and the authority structures in these organizations, you get a very clear focus on what they call women's virtues, female virtues of service, care, attentiveness to other people, respect, and they drop a lot of the language and concerns that have to do with command, mastery, and so forth, and demand more emotional labor, more reproductive labor out of men.
Even though, of course, the woman was still doing most of the child care and the housework of the men, it's kind of like Walmart, right? This honoring of that kind of work went a long way to change its appearance in the relations.
Exactly. I mean, again, we have sort of nationally set up this sector to win this argument, in the sense that if no one, you know, nationally the figures have barely budged in a century. Men do about half the work at home that women do, even when they're both full-time employed. And then if you add children to that equation, the numbers get even further out of whack. And this is, you know, I think there was a New York Times Magazine article on this just last summer, you know, how persistent this equation is. When the left, the labor left, looked for a minute at the feminist critique of the 70s, in which women said, you know, you've got to count housework, child rearing, reproductive work as labor, the sort of national consensus was, well, that's a nice idea, but not, we will let women into men's jobs, but we will not require men to make a comparable contribution at home. Well, if that's the larger reality, then within that, for someone to say, okay, we're also not going to change those numbers particularly, but we will make a point of praising you for what you're doing. We will make a point of taking it seriously. That is a better deal in many situations than to say, we're going to pretend that every worker out there is still the man in the gray flannel suit who has no responsibilities at home, who's not expected to participate in the work of running a household or rearing children, taking care of sick people, elderly people, which is what really most jobs still look like. We have not recalibrated full-time work to take recognition of the fact that it's now both men and women have to do some contribution at home. Evangelical culture, at very least, and it didn't have to be a lot better than the general culture because no one was really budging on this. It only had to be a little better to sound like a good bargain to a lot of people.
I speak with Bethany Morton, who is a professor at the University of Georgia and author of the book To Serve God in Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise, just out from Harvard University Press. And you have a phrase at one point, this new regime of soft hands but not limp wrists. Now, how does this softer patriarchy you've been talking about jibe with the paranoia in so much evangelical culture about abortionists and queers?
Well, at first it seems completely contradictory, but actually when you look at the evolution of this concept of family values as the dominant, if I say Christian, you say family values these days. If I say red state voter, you know what got someone to the polls. There was a gay marriage amendment on the ballot, right? We know that these are intimately intertwined. How did that come about? Well, if you look at the evolution of that concept within evangelical culture after about 1970, what you see is actually that these are loaded with so much significance, in part because they let most evangelicals off the hook. Really, the big questions in sexual morality for evangelicals in the 70s started out being things like rising divorce rates, infidelity, things that are part of many straight people's lives. But if you narrow it down to a couple of
it's staples
outlier,
of country music too, right?
exactly. Right. So it's not that they're being completely ignored in the culture. But narrowing it down to these two, on the one hand, gives you sort of a stalking horse for a much bigger concern without actually putting a whole lot of people within evangelical culture on the spot themselves. But at the same time, I think it also represents and is connected to the increasing importance of reproductive work itself. These are both homosexuality, sex that does not produce children in its purest descriptor, and abortion, the deliberate cessation of reproduction. These, I think, were so important because the necessity of bringing reproduction to the fore when, in fact, the state services, the kind of material support that would enable people to carry on lives outside of families, were shrinking. This is all going on in the context of neoliberal restructuring, if that's a familiar term for your listeners, the idea that in order to be internationally competitive, a country has to get rid of such luxuries as widely available health care or pensions and so forth. And so therefore the stakes, and this is work by many scholars, people like Lisa Dugan or Janet Jacobson, saying the stakes are extremely high now. To belong to a family is to belong to something that is legally recognized as a family, is to belong to a sort of surrogate provider of social services. It gives people access to that unpaid care work when, in fact, public sources of that kind of care have dried up. And so the stakes are very, very high for being appropriately legally certified to belong to a family. And if you're going to maintain the prestige of men on the job who are now doing what we used to call women's work, many of them, you've got to have a system in which they still have authority, but now it has to be based on their superior ability to serve, their servant leadership. And this involves bringing these kinds of suspect sexualities, these kinds of sins against reproduction into the spotlight and using them to define who is and is not in that that appropriate family. You have to look to in the 70s and 80s some of the economic architects of Reaganomics, of this new sort of Milton Friedman style economy are very explicit about this. They have no qualms saying, look, the reason, one good reason, they would say, not to allow gay people to be parts of families is it would be extremely expensive. They would show up and demand that their spouses get health insurance. They would, you know, who knows, they might try to, you know, insist that a polyamorous couple or, you know, multiple partners be included under health insurance. This would bankrupt us. They're very clear about the economic issues involved in, quote, family values. And we have to take them at their word that these two spheres really overlap, and they overlap in the workplace, they overlap in the home, they overlap in the ideologies and ideas that people use to understand those experiences. They're not, these cultural issues are not an alibi for some sneaky, unrelated economic model. They are really dependent on each other. So you can't really address one and say, oh, let's leave the other one for, you know, come the revolution, we'll deal with it. Or you people are engaged in identity politics, we're engaged in real economic policy. You know, these two can't really be addressed in isolation, I think, is the biggest lesson of an experience like Walmart's and its associated institutions.
That was Bethany Morton, a professor of history at Dartmouth and author of To Serve God at Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise from Harvard University Press. The interview was first broadcast in June 2009, shortly after that book was published. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this 1993 George Jones song that captures the spirit of Walmart, High Tech Redneck. Till next week, and a brand new show, bye.